ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Debutante balls may have started as a beacon of privilege, class, and overwhelming whiteness. But over generations, Aboriginal women and girls have reclaimed the practice and transformed it into a powerful act of black pride and joy. Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABC Radio National. This month, Belvoir Street Theatre is celebrating the revolutionary art and activism of the 1970s National Black Theatre in Redfern through its Redfern Renaissance programme. Curated by Angeline Penrith, it brings together a series of works and talks honouring the trailblazers that helped kickstart a broader movement for First Nations rights and recognition. And today, you'll revisit another piece of theatre honouring the rebels of Redfern, Big Girls Don't Cry. It's Delara Williams' joyous black play that debuted last April at Belvoir. It also marked a significant transition for Delara, who, having spent much of her career as an actor, turned her hand to writing and dramaturgy. Her play is set in Redfern in the 1960s and pays respect to a generation of black women who led the way and who weren't afraid to take a backward step. Stay with me here on Away. On a strangely balmy night in July 1968, something extraordinary happened at Sydney Town Hall. 25 young Indigenous women made their debut in front of a crowd of 300 people, including then Prime Minister John Gorton. These young black women didn't know it at the time, but that night they stepped onto a stage that would change history.
Now the big moment we have all been waiting for, introducing our debutantes from this Aboriginal Cultural Centre and partners. First step.
This wasn't just any debutante ball. This was a declaration. A moment of profound resistance, wrapped in white satin and carefully applied makeup. The Deb Ball had been organised by the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, an organisation started in an old funeral parlour on George Street in Redfern. From those humble beginnings came something revolutionary. It was a year after the 1967 referendum, where just over 90% of Australians had voted yes to Aboriginal rights. To some, these young women were symbolically coming of age as citizens of Australia. But this wasn't about playing by white society's rules. It was about transforming them. One debutante made headlines when she became the first Aboriginal woman to dance with the Prime Minister. But for the young Aboriginal women there, it was never about the politicians. It was about community, pride, and belonging. The night existed alongside the harsh realities of racism, the stolen generations, the daily struggles of Aboriginal communities. These women weren't trying to assimilate. They were declaring their existence. Actress and budding playwright Delara Williams has captured this spirit in her debut play, Big Girls Don't Cry. Set in Redfern in 1966, it tells a story of three Aboriginal women on the cusp of transformation, preparing for a night that was about so much more than dancing. Delara, how would you describe a Deb Ball to someone who's never experienced it? Oh, well, now if you explain it to somebody now, the first thing you can say is Bridgerton. It is a gathering. I can only say it with the perspective of Aboriginal debutantes. It is young people coming together and presenting themselves to society, dressing up in tuxedos and gowns. And the great thing about debutantes, the women have to ask the men to be their partners. And so it is this whole thing of just a different engagement to each other and go, will you be my partner? Will you escort me to this event? And from that, you present yourself in your gown and you have your partner there. You get escorted down the sort of runway. You end up in a circle and then you do your dance all together. It's a pageantry without the sort of pageantry. I think living or coming through the experience of Aboriginal people living on missionaries and with mission managers and that whole history, to coming out of that and fully it's pretty much blossoming and allowing yourself to blossom into your young adulthood. I think that is the best sort of way I can really explain it. And then you get to dance and you get to have fun.
And so what was it that drew you to the idea of a deb ball?
I don't think it initially started off as a deb ball or that was the goal. It initially started off with a conversation with my grandmothers and aunties. I would listen to their stories throughout my life, but this one specifically, I asked them what it was like to be in Redfern in the 60s. And more importantly, what was their social life in that? I think we get really caught up of what has happened through activism and protest, and that is so important. But the driving force through that was our social life, how we came together, how we ended up connecting with each other. And from that, they started talking about the Foundation of Aboriginal Affairs and other dances that they went to, which then led into what came about was the debutante and what it meant for them to become a debutante and to dress up in these gowns and be presented to society or to their society. My nan being one the first ones in Sydney, and her debut, I think she was 16, and you get to see these women in gowns, these really beautiful outfits, and you can't explain it. I'm just going, what that must feel coming from the mission and what you sort of are given there to then wearing an all-white gown and gloves and hair up. And a lot of these women love presenting themselves like that. So to have an organization to present something like the debutante for their community, even the men in suits, it really taught them along a lot about to be social with each other and these dances and these etiquette. I had my debut when I was really young. I think I was about 10. And you have the sort of the older group and then you have the juniors. And I think it was part of the juniors. And I remember going to the hairdressers and getting my hair done, just in this beautiful updo, and it had these little clips in there and it had like red, black and yellow ribbons and the silk satin dress that I had, and I was absolutely in love with it, and I had short lace gloves, and it was so magical to be a little black girl and see also all your cousins around you dressed up as the same way, and you get to see their dresses and see the boys in suits. And it is such a little dreamer world that I think I wanted to capture in Big Girls, because it is this continuation of community in the different ways that how we approach community. I think I wrote in sort of the author's note of it being a story about dreamers, and these three women are a really beautiful example of that. Very different ways of how they dream up their world, how they exist in their world. You have Cheryl that is sort of in between
a rock and a hard place. She has her boyfriend who is fighting in Vietnam at that time, and she doesn't know where she sits in the city. And so it's really her decision of whether to stay in the city or go back home to country. Lulu just oozes the idea of a dreamer. I call her the original go-go dancer. And it's that fun and joy of just wanting to go out and socialize and the potential to see the world. And we have Queenie, who is named very perfectly because she goes on like a queen. And it is that pure confidence of just owning yourself in this space. And just how a lot of people gravitate towards that energy, which I know a lot of Aboriginal people experience that, because I feel like a lot of Aboriginal women have that energy that just oozes, I don't know, it's like light and sex appeal and just absolutely divine. And that's something that Queenie carries through the play.
Because there are a lot of ways and places where we get to celebrate, but not necessarily like across all ages. There's something powerful about holding that joy and like making space for that joy. I think in particular, so often the kinds of plays that you perform in are engaging in a moment of grief.
Oh yeah. I always say that those stories are very important, because Aboriginal people are really, as sad as it may sound, are really great in dealing with grief. They really understand when sorry business comes about and who and the roles that family members or community take up when grief is presented to us. But there has to be some balance, because as much as we need to grieve, you see these, or I see these in a lot of funerals I've been to, there comes a time when you then celebrate that person's life. And a lot of that is through laughter and telling these funny stories and who these people really were that bring everyone, and everyone knows that story or they'll join in, but it's all through laughter. And that's something that we also need to look at, that laughter is really a big part of our survival, that we, after everything, after a lot of knockbacks, after a lot of things that this colony has done to the Aboriginal community, that we still have a sense of humour and we're able to look at ourselves and laugh and have that joy, that that hasn't been ripped out of us and lost. And that's what I really wanted to showcase, was Black joy. And no matter what room you go into, especially when there's a group of Blackfellas there, you can hear them down the road. You know when there's a gathering of that, because it is laughter, and that's what gravitates everybody towards this group of us, just truly celebrating ourselves in just tiny moments.
Now, you've been pulling double duty on Big Girls Don't Cry.
Yeah.
I think it's important to acknowledge. So not only are you the writer of this show, you are performing in it when it opens at Belvoir. What has that experience been like for you?
I don't think it's difficult, but it's not easy, if that is like the easiest way to put it. It's understanding what hat you're putting on. And maybe because I've sat with this play for a long time and I'm also writing it as an actor and seeing it as probably visualizing it as a director, and so putting all these multiple hats to now getting up and performing it, I always question myself, going, why did I write this? Why did I say yes to this? But I think it all comes down to it, of going, I've been in Aboriginal theatre and performed in Aboriginal theatre for about 10 years now. And this is something that I think my soul craves. It's something that it's the reason why I fell in love with acting in the first place. You grow up watching things like Wizard of Oz and rom-coms, and seeing that, I just go, oh, that's why I wanted to act. I wanted to be able to have these very intimate and loving connections with the people I love, in these characters that I absolutely adore. and to have for an Aboriginal audience to be able to connect with that. I think grief sort of hits only a certain percentage of people, but the thing that connects us all, that keeps bringing us back together, is that joy. And why not write something that you want to see?
And you've also, I know that you've, you're joined by an incredible cast. And I mean, I get the sense that you guys are all friends as well.
I mean, no, we are.
No. I mean, no, let's run them down now.
I could never.
No, but it's Ian Michael directing, Megan Wilding, yourself and Steph Somerville are playing the three young women.
We have the lovely guy Simon.
Of course.
Matthew Cooper. And then you have the lovely Nick English and Bryn Chapman.
I mean, that is an incredible cast to be working with. How important was it for you as having your playwright debut to be surrounded by so many familiar and friendly faces?
Oh my goodness. I pretty much think it's fate. I think it's writing it with that intention of Black excellency, and who else can I get what than the people across from me? I've known Megan Wilding for 14 years. We studied together. When we met each other, a lot of our connections were through music, the love of the Beatles and romantic stories. And I think we started dreaming up together. I've known Ian Michaels for over 10 years. And watching him grow into this director, in such fabulous plays, to have his mind in the room. And also Steph Somerville, we graduated the same year. I graduated from NIDA. She was from WAPA. And even though there were just such different experiences, to have us all come together, and I cannot imagine another cast, especially for the very first. I go to be surrounded with such wonderful Blackness, unapologetic Blackness and boldness. It's more than I can ever ask.
In talking about your connection to music with Megan, you've reminded me how important music is to setting your show. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yeah. How I write, especially period pieces, I love to make playlists, and I love to make playlists of going, what were they listening to on the radio? What was surrounding them? Because you look at the stories or the songs in the 60s, as obvious as it is, you use the Beatles or singing I Want to Hold Your Hand and talking about new love and all that kind of energy around that. So I love making playlists and seeing everything that came out. Motown, my grandmother gave me a best of Motown when I was in high school, and I remember listening to that on my Walkman device way before MP3s, and constantly hearing the Supremes and the Ronettes. And what comes with music comes with fashion, which comes with the culture of it. And to also speak to my aunties and go, what did you listen to? And they love Dusty Springfield because they wanted to wear their hair and makeup like her. And so music influenced their life. So why not make influence such a driving force, or a little, how would I say, to be able to create that world is straight through what's been playing on the radio for them.
How has the show changed and developed since you first started working on it?
Oh, it's changed. It's changed a lot, but it hasn't moved away from the vision that I wanted. Having a lot of other actors and now a director, and having their minds a part of it, they have such beautiful thoughts, and it all comes from a place of love to lift up this story. So it was all there. It was just sort of chipping away at the marble to get the sculpture. And it's changed completely. The Big Girls started off as a film, and I wanted to write it as a film. And then I think my elders are getting older, and because I wanted it for them, I think the easiest path for that was to somehow change it into a play. So even the initial film script has completely changed to the stage script, has now completely changed again now that you have other minds in the room. But yeah, the essence and what I truly wanted is still there, and that's something that I'm absolutely grateful for.
Does that mean that you're still kind of thinking about eventually seeing a screen?
Maybe. I would love to do that. And also because it's been on this big journey, to change it back to a film script or a television script, is it would just have so much more depth and understanding, because I've had to explore each character individually of what their journey is. So when you pack it in again through a different medium, such as film, it would just make it a little bit more holistic in that. And also I get to capture what you can do on film, what you can't do on stage is, I always say this going, sometimes it's hard when you write for stage, because in film you can solve it with a look. It's just a look. You zoom in on their hands and all this other stuff, and you can't really show that on stage. And so it'll be really a really wonderful journey to see how it would change if I ever decide to change it back into a screenplay.
Because, I mean, not to kind of draw parallels between, but like, it's hard not to think of The Sapphires when I think about Big Girls Don't Cry, which famously started as a stage show that then.
I got to see it at the Seymour Centre in 2010, and that was with Christine Arnoux, Casey Donovan, Kylie Bracknell. And there was also, I saw it the second time, and I think Casey Donovan, I think she was off sick, and Usha Jovic came and stepped in for her, for Cynthia. And so it was really great to see these women and that story and the use of Motown. Of course, it's such a big influence and it changed my life watching something like that on stage, especially at the very beginning of my training.
I saw The Sapphires at Belvoir. So that was the Usha Jovic, Deb Mailman, Rachel Mazur, and Lisa Flanagan.
What a team.
I think there's something really gorgeous about the fact that that show, it's Sydney debut happened at Belvoir. You're having your debut at Belvoir. And this year, as a theatre company, they have actually been they did earlier this year celebrate their connection to the Redfern community and Black theatre.
Yeah.
How much of that has been on your mind as you've been writing?
It's, I think also still living in Redfern and also having family that still lives in Redfern, seeing Redfern Renaissance with Angeline Penrith. Me and Angeline always have these really like in-depth conversations about what it is like to be a resident of Redfern, especially generationally. And not only a lot of people looking at the past and what Redfern has done, not only for the community, not only for Sydney, but for Australia, what has come out of that, what has birthed out of that. And also this year is the 60th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, which is my grandfather, Gary Williams, was part of, also being one of the first Aboriginal men to go to the Sydney Uni, along with Charlie Perkins. And so it's really to have family that have constantly been engaged with this community, engaged with activism and this work, has nothing but influenced my life and my artistry, especially when you start reflecting on your own work and yourself and how you're supposed to pour that back into art and community. So, yeah, I think it's a circle. There's no beginning or end. It is forever there.
You're listening to Away with me, Rudy Bremer, on Radio National. Earlier, you heard how stories of Delara Williams' own grandmother's dead ball inspired her to write her play Big Girls Don't Cry. Now you're about to dive into the world of Aboriginal debutantes and how they're turning this archaic practice on its head. If you haven't grown up with stories and memories of dead balls, it might seem odd to see mob wholeheartedly embrace such an elitist, classist, and, let's face it, sexist tradition. But like that night almost 60 years ago at Sydney's Town Hall, blackfellas have reimagined dead balls and made them our own.
Oh, the dead balls, man, they are so good.
My eldest daughter and my youngest son both did debutantes.
They're the most amazing merits for people to ever have.
I could imagine putting on that dress and the gloves and having your hair done and your makeup done and just feeling so pretty for a night.
It was a white satin dress. It had a little skirt on the back from the waist down past her backside, and it just gave it another little swish when she did the waltzing.
But your debutante, it's like it's a community thing, and it's not just you and your friends, it's you getting to know everybody.
It was kind of that longing to be a part of something that looked so pretty.
It's a special dance, like debut, sounds flash.
I was thinking, how would I have convinced any of the guys at my high school at 17 or 18 to do weeks of dance rehearsals and dress up with me?
I remember wearing a green bow tie. It was the flashiest thing that I had.
And they did my hair, and I swear I came out and I decided that in the mirror I looked like a pumpkin.
Will you be my partner? Will you escort me?
We can, and we do, make it with everybody else.
At first, the thought of Aboriginal girls plunging headlong into the white tulle and tiaras of a somewhat outdated and nonsensical custom like coming out is a bit alarming. But perhaps for an Aboriginal girl, the idea of making your debut socially means something even more.
I'm just the same as a white girl. You know, I can do things like work girls, I'm not casted away. You know, I can go into a hall and everybody looks at you and say, oh, she's just the same as a white girl. Just because you're different coloured skin doesn't mean nothing, you know? You're the same? I can't explain.
You're very white tonight, as white as you can possibly
be. Oh, naturally, yeah, the dress, but not the colour.
Is that so important to be white?
Yeah, no, I don't want to be white. I want to stay my own colour. You know, I'm proud of being Aboriginal.
That was a clip from 1973 of Lynn McLeod, a young Aboriginal woman in Nowra. She's speaking to a white reporter on the night of her deb. The video is in black and white, and Lynn is on the precipice of adulthood, mere moments away from taking her first steps into the Shoalhaven local community as a young lady, along with her peers from the Shoalhaven District Aboriginal Cultural Centre.
Introducing our debutantes from the Shoalhaven District Aboriginal Cultural Centre and partners. First step, Miss Marlene Wellington.
Watching it, I can't help but think of the women in my family who've made their debut. Which brings me to my own history with the debutante tradition. I've been to a couple of balls, but when I think about debutante balls, I always think of that first one. Picture this. I'm just 5 years old and wearing my very best party dress. It's made of peach satin and it came to me third hand by way of family friends. Everywhere you look, there's beautiful women in white dresses and handsome men in tuxedos with hot pink bow ties. But this was no ordinary debut. The participants were a little older than usual. In the 50s and 60s, when my nan and her sisters were young women, they weren't invited to make their debut. This particular night was a special dead ball, held for elders like my Auntie Glad, so they could experience all the glitz and glamour they'd missed out on after they'd been deliberately excluded from their own local dead balls as teenagers. There are photos from that night that still hold pride of place in the lounge rooms and dining rooms of my mob. I've grown up with stories from one other dead ball, and I thought I'd take the opportunity to do something I don't often do. I turned the mic on my mum.
Do I have to say my name and...
Yes, please.
Hello, my name's Kerry Toomey and I'm a Gamilaroi woman from Piliga Scrub.
Mum, tell me about your debut.
Do you know, when I was travelling home from school, 16 years old on the school bus, and some girls were cruising around on the bus and inviting people to be part of a debut. And they came up to me and my cousin sitting on the bus and talked about it, you know, talked it up. And I thought, yep, I'll be in that. No idea what I was, except that you got frocked up and you go to learn some a dance or a couple of dances and everybody will be there. So, yeah, of course. Sounds like a lot of fun. But I got home and I thought, I don't know, I really don't know what I said yes to. And talked to my mum and the aunties, because usually when we got off the bus and got home, you all sit around outside and fill them in on the day of what you did at school. And I talked about it and they went, oh, that'll be great. We weren't allowed to do that sort of stuff when we were young, so that'll be really cool. I still don't know what, right, at this point, don't know what I've said yes to, except that it is a dance, but obviously it's a special dance, like debut, sounds flash. Anyway, you go to dance lessons to learn how to do the Pride of Erin, I think it was.
And it's forward.
And you're supposed to come with a friend or a partner. I had no partner. So my brother's best friend, my mum went up to him and asked him if he would be my partner. And he accepted because he's my brother's best friend. So I feel safe. That's okay. So I got a partner. Still don't understand the whole concept about what debuts are, but I'm in there. And the closer we get to the event... I got no dress. Everybody else is sailing along, people getting dresses made, going to have fittings. I still got no dress. No shoes, no white shoes to dance in. Starting to get a little bit stressed, but no, still turning up to my little practice sessions with my brother's best friend. Bless him. He was very polite and good company. And we turn around and it's about nearly 2 weeks before the debut and I've still got no dress, no shoes, no outfit. Everybody else is up, ready for it. I'm standing with a group of kids at school after a sports session with my favourite sports teacher, Kerry Noonan. And she made an announcement and she said, oh, if there's anybody in the group that hasn't got a debut dress, I've got one. It's just hanging in the cupboard. Feel free. It's just there. So I waited until everybody disappeared because really, like there's three black fellas at the debut. I'm related to, it's my two cousins and myself. And so I went over to her and I said, I haven't got a dress. Can I borrow your dress? She said, absolutely. She said, I'll put it in the dry cleaners. It'll be ready for you. So I'm thinking, well, at least I got a dress now. When I picked the dress up off her, had the plastic from the dry cleaners and in a nice little bag, and I took it home, pulled it out. It was absolutely beautiful. Just a little bit big. So I pinned it onto my bra strap so that when I'm dancing, it won't slip off me. But I was feeling really good. Still got no shoes. So one of the aunties checked in on me and she said, so what shoes are you wearing with that beautiful dress? I said, I got none. She said, we'll go shopping. So she took me shopping. She bought me my shoes. Another auntie came along. She said, oh, you can't go without jewellery. You need a little bit of zhuzh. So Auntie Gleb bought me a choker, and it was this silver choker. Look, I was on fire, mate. I was ready for it. By the time I went shopping, there's hardly any white shoes left. We're in a country town, so you had to be in early to get the good stuff. So the one pair of shoes that fit me were a little bit sort of boyish, but I loved them because they suited me, because I can wear them with my jeans when this is all over. This is not a one event pair of shoes. These shoes are going to last. Actually, on the day, everybody went to have their hair done. So one of the other aunties turned up and said, you need to have your hair done as well. So I go to the hairdressers without an appointment, last minute, you know. And they did my hair. And I swear I came out and I decided that in the mirror I look like a pumpkin. Because my hairdo, it honestly looked like a pumpkin stuck on my head. I hated it. So I put my jumper over my head and caught the bus home because I didn't want anyone to see my daggy pumpkin hairdo. And I walked in the door and I started to cry. So my mum fixed up my hair and it was beautiful. I looked normal again. She just brushed it out a bit and got the hairspray. So I got my stiff hair. We walked down to the CWA for the photo shoot. Fantastic. Everybody's given gloves. Everybody's given a little bunch of flowers to stand around and get their photos done, which was fantastic. And then you get to go to the hall, for the big debut. Finally get to enjoy this debut thing where you present it to somebody in town. I still don't know who it was, but they were supposedly significant people in town. The significant people for me, when I walked to that door with my partner, my brother's best friend, I could see my mob all together because it was a community that got me there, you know, my cousins and my aunties and my uncles who helped our family pull it together. And as I danced around, I swear I can't remember anybody else in that hall except my mob and how proud they were when we came around the corner. And I did. In every practice, they used to say, if you miss a step and you're off beat, don't worry about it. Now I'd do the big skip to fix myself up. And they all cracked up. They thought it was really funny. But I just thought, I'm here. I got my shoes. I'm dancing. And it was great. And I can still, to this day, just even bringing it up and thinking about it, it makes me feel good inside, just thinking about my mob all there, you know, how important that was to them. And I thought about my mum and my aunties not being involved in those sorts of things. And there we were representing our mob and loving it. So my two cousins, Billy and Betty, and myself, we danced all night. Said the mob, we were on the dance floor all the time. So it was a great night.
Around about when would this have been?
In the 70s, because I was only 16. I have to do the maths on that and I'm a bit doughy.
That's okay, 70s is fine.
Yeah, 70s. Like, really cool. It's still, you know, there were things that happened around town that sometimes we weren't included in. To be involved in this community event was really fun. It wasn't as scary as I thought, but if my mob didn't step up, I don't know what I was going to do without a dress. Oh, my God. When I think about it. But I had faith, you know, right to the end of it. I went to every rehearsal. Still missed a beat when I walked through the door, but never mind. I had to do a little skip and muck myself up, but it was cool.
What do you think is the most important thing you learnt from your going to your debut, from taking part?
The most important part is being, like, accepting the challenge, right, for a start. But when we got there, we're the same as everybody else. Everybody else was nervous. It wasn't just us, right? Everybody else had their families there supporting them. But for us, for our, for for my mum to stand on the side and watch and be really, really, like, you could feel the energy from our mob, that it meant a lot that we were representing our families out there. And I'm glad I did it for that, and that rush of being, standing up for our mob, you know, because you heard about things along the way where people weren't allowed to do things, or we get put down, or you hear the comment at school, because we did hear a lot of racist comments at school from some kids, and they stick. You don't unhear that. But on that night, it was that community came together, and I know everybody else was happy to see us there as well, but I had eyes for my family. I was like, I got introduced to some dude down the front who was the main guest. I can't remember him at all, but I can remember my mob all standing together. I can remember the way that they looked. I can remember them, the hugs that they gave after we finished, like we'd just done a big marathon. But it wasn't. It was just going down the hall, having a dance and a dinner. Too cool.
When I think about this DeBrew story, how my mum borrowed this beautiful dress from her teacher, how her aunties and my nan made sure she looked and felt beautiful, it reaffirms what Delara's talking about. There's something powerful about holding space for Black joy and for our community to be together in joy. That doesn't mean it's always been the case. I spoke to Kelly Williams, the Director of First Nations Strategy at the ABC, to see what her memories are of this rite of passage.
Hi, I'm Kelly Williams. I'm a Bundjalung woman from northern New South Wales. My relationship with debutante balls is zilch. We were not allowed to participate when I grew up in and around Casino, New South Wales. It was never a thing that we aspired to. We always saw it from afar. It was just a generally known fact that if you were Aboriginal, you were not included. There was always that line of separation between being Aboriginal and everyone else. I think driving past and seeing all the girls in their dresses and thinking how beautiful they looked, and even though you knew you couldn't participate, it was kind of that longing to be a part of something that looked so pretty, and a kind of sadness that that was a world that you weren't part of. I could imagine putting on that dress and the gloves and having your hair done and your makeup done and just feeling so pretty for a night. Like the closest I have ever come to being a deb or attending a debutante ball is, well, firstly seeing Beyonce's Brown Skin Girls. That made me cry because I just thought, look at all those beautiful black girls in their deb dresses. But the other is like going to the National NAIDOC Awards every year. That's my deb ball. I get to dress up and look beautiful and wear a nice dress and nice hair and makeup. I kind of feel like Debs are in the past, and I really love the fact that there's a play that focuses on Aboriginal women participating in that for everyone else to see. And I hope that some of those white girls who did their Deb in Casino go and look at that play, because often everyone else who isn't Aboriginal in this country forgets to see Aboriginal people in their everyday activities that they do as part of their, like, becoming adults. And it's so nice to see Aboriginal representation in that.
Just like Kelly, Charlene Emson-Boyd, a Bundjalung woman from the north coast of New South Wales, never got to participate in a Deb ball herself. But two of her children have.
My eldest daughter and my youngest son both did debutantes. So my daughter's debutante was the first. It was a big treat being an Aboriginal family in a small community. You know, they practiced the dances, and I used to do a little bit of sewing, so I made her dress. So it was a white satin dress, long sleeves, long dress. We wanted to go a little bit different with no lace, so it had a flounce or like a half trail on the back. So it had a little skirt on the back from the waist down past her backside, and it just gave it another little swish when she did the waltzing. So that was beautiful. Her grandmother came down for it. Her auntie came down for it. A close friend of mine, an elderly lady, did her hair and makeup. And so it was all new, because I'd never had anything like that myself. And then my son, when he was in year 12, he was asked to be a partner. And we had the conversation about if someone asks you, you know, out of politeness and respect, you need to do that. So he did. I was really proud that they were able to be a part of it in a small white community, and we had Aboriginal people apart and connected and showing people we can and we do make it with everybody else.
Debutante bowls have been taken up by lots of regional communities in Australia, and they've got a bit of a reputation as a somewhat unkillable tradition. What's clear is, despite the community that takes on this rite of passage, all come to it with their own hopes and dreams. I spoke to Harley Lang, a newly debuted woman in the Riverina region of New South Wales.
So my name's Harley Lang. I'm 17 years old. I'm from Wagga Wagga. I'm a small country girl and enjoy getting around the community and doing things. So my debutante, it was about 3 months ago that we did it. I had a broken ankle at the time after a sports tournament. I ended up going with one of my best mates to it. He was really worried at first when I came back with a broken ankle. He's like, so you're going to be able to dance, right? I think the one thing I can say is I hope more young girls do the debutantes, like whether it's the Koori girls or it's just like a normal debutante for the little towns or whatever, because they're the most amazing nights for people to ever have. Like, you got to have other nights, like your formals and stuff, but your debutante, it's like it's a community thing, and it's not just you and your friends, it's you getting to know everybody. And like, you can wear your mum's old dress, or you could go and pick a dress that catches your eye. And I mean, we organised as debutantes and the partners, we all organised surprises for the people running it and stuff, because my mum and all my aunts were running it. So we got them like flowers, chocolates. Yeah.
Debutante balls. Whether you embrace them or not, looks like they're here to stay. That was Harley Lang, one of Wagga Wagga's most recent debutantes. You also heard from Kerry, Sean, Kelly, Alinia, Charlene, Kelrick, and, of course, playwright and star of Big Girls Don't Cry, Delara Williams. Since we first brought you this yarn, Big Girls Don't Cry had a triumphant season at Sydney's Belvoir Street Theatre, bringing those glorious stories of black debutantes from Redfern's Block to the stage. You're listening to Away with me, Rudy Bremer, on Radio National. And it's time now for Word Up. Dr. Jessie Hodgetts is a senior lecturer of global Indigenous studies at the University of Newcastle. His research focuses on First Nations cultural revitalization and the continuation of knowledge systems. Through his work, Jessie has used music to help revitalise his own languages, including the Nyampa dialect, Wangaipun. It's been a huge undertaking, and throughout December, he's sharing some of the words he's uncovered. Today, it's one that's been misunderstood for years.
Pukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia. One word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walter.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Dyangye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Reipiri.
Ngaraguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka.
Wakaniniana.
Wadadawiya.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Tiepa.
Murupuk.
I'm Jesse Hodgetts. I'm a Wangaipon, Nyampa and Wiradjuri Mei. That's the languages of my ancestors. And Dakanong country is the country that I'm speaking from today and the country that I was born and raised. My next word is Goyen. And Goyen has been translated as meaning shame or shy. If you think about that in a Western or English or Australian lens, you'll see that as a negative connotation of you don't want to be Goyen. But when I heard old Nyampa woman, Aunty Eliza Kennedy, she was another important Nyampa woman that kept our language. She talked about Goyen in terms of being respectful. So she would say that when strangers would come into their camp, strange adults, that they needed to be Goyen to them and not look at them and not talk to them and only if they're spoken to. And she says that was just the black's law. That's how we behave. We were Goyen. We were respectful. So definitely not a negative thing. It's actually reinforces your inner strength. And discipline and security within yourself to be Goyen and humble, to be humble. And in extending to that is Goyengen. Goyengen is, once again, gets translated as meaning to own something. That's the Western understanding. But it really more so means something that's for you and that you're for it. So I could say my balka is Goyengen. My boomerangs are Goyengen. They're my boomerangs, but I'm going in for them boomerangs too. So they own me just as much as I own them. And I can say Goyengen the Yawaradu, I mind my own business. So you can see how Goyen and Goyengen can be related. They're connected. Goyengen can be my family. I can say May's people. Mandy Goyengen, so like my own people that I have relationship with as well. So Goyen, shame, but respectful and humble, and Goyengen, something that's for me. To stay true to what I've been taught by my old people, they would say, when you're leaving, you'd say, Yanakatono. Yanakatono means, it just means, it's like a farewell, but it kind of means I'm going away from you now. And they just leave. They don't make a big deal out of it. Yana kotono, because they're Goyen and they're humble and respectful. So, yana kotono.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Dr. Jesse Hodgetts sharing a little more of his Nyampa dialect, Wangaipan. You can catch the full series of Word Up, including more from Jesse, on the ABC Listen app. And that's our show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on Gadigal Country. Our technical producer is Simon Branthwaite. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can always find us on the ABC Listen app, along with our Titter program Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Berendt. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.